In the non-cartoon world, it's a more subtle, gradual shifting process than that. There aren't perfect children of light straightening out utter children of darkness. We're all unique, complicated mixtures on the outside, and simple, pure beingness on the inside, with our own shifting inner tides of forgetting and remembering what's what. That's why we're all on the buddy system with this stuff, all the same space-like awareness, embodied and embuddied in different forms. When I remind you of your true nature, I'm talking to myself. Next time, you'll remind me. Part 4. View. Chapter 30. That Guy. In our project of finding the dimension beyond fear and learning how to live from there, we've so far focused mostly on practice, method, technique, stuff that you do, even if it's done effortlessly. But the great meditative traditions also stress a second essential element, view or insight. This doesn't mean opinion or idea. The terms are used more literally, view as in, from this mountaintop my view of our town is more panoramic. Insight as in seeing into the way things are. Sometimes nothing needs to change about what is. We just need a shift in perspective to see it more clearly as it is. One day, a man comes home to find that there's a tiger in his living room. Naturally, he's distressed. His pulse races, his blood pressure spikes, his mind reels. He can try any number of tactics to deal with the tiger. Tippy-toe carefully around it, beat pots and pans to shoo it out the door, start Googling tiger exterminators near me. While he waits for the exterminator to show up, he might take medication to settle his blood pressure, or even meditate to calm his mind. But then his wife comes home and says, "Hi, honey, do you like my new paper tiger? Isn't it lifelike?" Suddenly, without the aid of meditation, medication, or extermination, his mind and his blood pressure settle down, although he may ask his wife to please text ahead next time. The exact same experience of tiger shape and tiger colors is still coming through his eyes, but his view has shifted. All is well, and the man realizes it always has been. Life, say the awakened sages, is a paper tiger. This shift cuts through needless suffering. It's not that we find a new solution to our problems, a new improved tiger gun. It's that we see there never was a problem. You may have noticed that sometimes, when you open your eyes at the end of a meditation session, everything seems somehow simpler, less chaotic, less problematic than it was going in. Nothing has changed about the outer situation, and you haven't spent your meditation finding ingenious solutions to your problems. You may have spent it trying to find solutions. That's okay. Everyone does for a while. But then you give up, and your focus relaxes into a more panoramic, big-sky mode, where the same life situations, the same pixels, we could say, resolve themselves into more coherent, more spacious, less oppressive ways of being seen. Usually, this glow of everything okay just as it is fades after some minutes or hours. But as our explorations mature, it stays with us more and more. We begin to realize that it's not just some peculiar side effect of meditative relaxation, like a microdose of some euphoric drug. We intuitively know that this delicious simplicity is more real than all the tangled drama we formerly superimposed upon it. It's self-evident. There's nothing magic about it. The real black magic, the real sleight of hand, was our old, narrow, problem-filled view. What sorcery is not that our fear vanishes, but that a paper tiger could ever have frightened us. "Come and see," said the Buddha. It finally turns out to be that simple. Emily Dickinson said that what we need, rather than revelation, is unfurnished eyes. That is, our redemption from fear and suffering won't come when at last an angel arrives and whispers some cosmic revelation in our ear, or when we find just the right page of the right scripture or self-help book, or when we have the super-orgasmic psychedelic meditation experience we've been fantasizing about. All we need to do is relax our focus to see past the old confusion, the clutter of conceptual furniture that's been obstructing our unfurnished view. As Sri Nisargadatta said, don't try to understand. It's enough that you don't misunderstand. We don't need some kind of super eyes, just clear, naked, unfurnished eyes. The True Guru. In our meditation group in Northern State Prison, I'm officially the teacher, but I've learned at least as much as I've taught, especially about view. One night, sometime in our first year or two, we were meeting as usual in the cinder block chapel, about 15 of us in our circle of blue plastic chairs, and the conversation turned to dealing skillfully with corrections officers, COs or cops as they're usually called. Roy, a moon-faced, 40-ish Filipino with long, straight black hair pulled back in a ponytail, said, "Well, hey, I'm lucky to be here in the meeting tonight. The cop on my tier is that guy. He thinks we're doing devil worship here, and sometimes he doesn't get around to letting me out." Wait, I said, "what do you mean, that guy?" Roy was a talented artist who taught drawing and painting classes in the education wing, so he was used to explaining things patiently. "That guy," as in, everything would be fine if it wasn't for that guy. Sometimes that guy is a cop trying to prove how big his dick is, so you keep your eyes down and stay clear of him as much as you can. Sometimes it's someone back home that keeps making your life complicated. Could be your wife. Sometimes it's your celly, which is tough. That's day in and day out. If he smokes or plays his radio all day or won't stop talking, you're stuck with it. Other members of the group started jumping in with stories of intolerable cellmates, past and present. Jimmy, a white-haired former bantamweight boxer who was easily agitated, started in on his current celly. "It's not just that he talks so much. Everything he says is stupid. He thinks he's an expert on everything, and he goes on and on, yammering about any subject he thinks of, just making stuff up, and he has no idea he's doing it. He's too stupid to know he's stupid." Me. Okay, I hear you. But I want to get back to something Roy said. Everything would be fine if it wasn't for that guy. Is that true? Jimmy. Well, yeah, life would be much better if my guy just went away. I wouldn't have to keep controlling my urge to sock him. Me. Have any of you ever had a situation where that guy did go away? Yeah? And then what happens? Silence. Then Roy broke into a broad grin. Then someone else becomes that guy. Everybody laughed. I said, maybe it's like those name tags that people wear at conventions. "Hello, I'm Fred." There's one that says, "Hello, I'm that guy," and it just keeps getting passed around. But what can we do with this? Is there a way to use that guy as part of our practice? We kicked the idea around a little, and then I had another thought. Do you know what the Dalai Lama says about his guru? Our group had been studying Tibetan Buddhism, and everyone was familiar with Tibet's modern history. The Chinese communist invasion of Tibet, ordered by Mao Zedong, where troops tortured and killed 1 million Tibetans, destroyed 98% of the temples, and forced the young Dalai Lama to flee into exile. Whenever someone asks the Dalai Lama who is his Lama, his guru, you know what he says? Mao Zedong. Mao, I explained, Mao, the brutal invader, was the one who taught him to be patient and compassionate, to bear the unbearable by finding the silent place inside that remains always untouched, but then keep getting up every morning and work to make things better. For the Dalai Lama, Mao Zedong is that guy. And that guy, we decided, whoever he or she is always your guru. This insight that your nemesis is your true guru is a steep teaching. If it's too steep for you right now, fine, maybe come back to it next month or next year. Everything's optional. But because it's steep, exploring it can take you very high, very fast. Your moody, unreasonable supervisor, your crooked business partner, your vindictive ex, your addicted child, your neurotic sibling, your narcissistic parent, what do you got? Whoever it is that makes you say, this can't be okay, if only it weren't for this I'd be in the clear, that's your teacher. Sometimes it might not be a person, but a situation. If only it weren't for this job, or this joblessness, or this toothache, or this cancer. Hard as it might be, if you can take a step back and get a big picture view, you might realize that somehow life is so perfectly choreographed that at every moment you get exactly the teacher you need. And what is it that all these teachers, or the one teacher in all these different guises, is teaching you? That your okayness doesn't depend on anything. Sometimes, especially if you're stubborn, your guru, that guy, uses tough love tactics and makes things so uncomfortable on the surface that you're forced to seek the depths. He provides exactly the thing you fear or hate, the one you're sure you can't be okay with, so that you have to be with it and find out you're still okay because you're okayness itself. Terrified of snakes? Here's a snake. In the Buddhist and Hindu cultures, the Lama or Guru is given the highest reverence. He or she ranks right along with your parents as one to whom you are unrepayably indebted, for whom you can never feel enough gratitude. To us egalitarian Westerners, it can seem strange to see people prostrate themselves before their teachers or touch their feet in greeting, but to traditional Easterners, it's natural. Someone once asked one of my teachers why he bowed down to a picture of his own teacher, and he replied, "I don't bow down, I fall down." So, are you ready? Can you take on that reverent gratitude and direct it toward your loudmouth uncle who spouts obnoxious, ignorant political opinions at every family gathering? Or toward the oblivious driver going 45 in the left lane of the freeway when you're in a desperate hurry? Or the colleague in your office who keeps screwing up projects and shifting the blame to you? Or the competing author whose shallow, repetitive, ghost-written, best-selling books keep pushing yours off the shelves? Clearly, this is a big shift in view. But because it's view, not method, there's nothing you have to do about it. Don't prostrate yourself at your bloviating uncle's feet. Don't try to repress your anger at your ex. Don't strain to maintain a fabricated grin-and-bear-it attitude. And don't try to explain your new improved spiritual perspective to that guy. Just know that, like it or not, life has served up the teacher you require. You can't unhear this. The seed of this knowledge has already been planted. See what happens. In time, you'll probably see that this knowledge pulls the rug out from under much of your fear and anger. How can you fear the precious teacher who is giving you just what you need? How can you be angry with him? And if you can't be angry with that guy, your very nemesis, how can you be angry with lesser culprits? They're just your guru's teaching assistants. As anger starts to slip away, leaving clarity in its place, you see what a waste of life energy it was. The Dalai Lama has said that while you toss and turn, losing sleep over the wrongs committed against you, the wrongdoer is sleeping like a baby, having long since forgotten the whole thing. In close tandem with anger, this shift also pulls the rug out from under blame. Yes, blame is lame, but blame is not the same as responsibility. If you're running, say, an office or a classroom or a household, it's often important to ascertain that Wendy was responsible for leaving the stove on, or Max was responsible for feeding Twizzlers to the hamster, so that you can help them correct their behavior. But those are matter-of-fact situational assessments, followed by appropriate adjustments. Blame, on the other hand, has a jagged emotional charge whose function is to make people feel bad about themselves. Christians wisely say to hate the sin and love the sinner. Blame is designed to judge and convict the sinner, to say or imply, "Oh, Wendy, what did you do this time?" Or, "Max, you're such a screw-up." By the way, don't try to tell other people that blame is lame and therefore they shouldn't blame you. This is for you to know. In fact, in many situations, office politics, family politics, because most people are so caught up in dodging blame at all costs, being loose enough to accept some can give you great power. At the right time, an unexpected, deftly applied, "Oh gee, my bad," can suddenly take the air out of a lot of unnecessary drama. I learned a lot about blame from my mother, who was warm and charming in many ways, but whose swift, fiery judgments made her an excellent guru in this department. I remember driving with her one rainy day and hearing her shout curses at the driver in front of us whenever his car hit a puddle and, naturally, splashed ours. One Thanksgiving day, she drove to the in-laws' house where the dinner was to take place. She had a bad knee, so arrangements had been made to leave her an empty parking spot in the driveway, near the front door. But someone had not gotten the word, and when she arrived, there was no spot for her. She parked halfway down the block, limped to the house with her sweet potato casserole in hand, and entered shouting, "Who's the idiot that took my parking spot?" That Thanksgiving dinner ended before it began. In meditation, that guy becomes the barking dog or the nagging thoughts, until it's the next thing. From this perspective, meditation is a form of training for being at peace with that guy. Sit, close the eyes, take some comfy on-ramp, rest as awareness. And then, beep, 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 beep. Shit! How can I be at peace with that effing car alarm? Whose car is that? When are they going to outlaw those effing things? Where's my baseball bat? I'm going to go massage his windshield. Eventually, you may settle for waiting for it to stop, and then you'll be at peace. But if you're lucky, it keeps going through your whole meditation. Or it stops, but then someone in the next room starts yakking on their phone. "Why is she shouting? Why doesn't she close the door?" Fine. Go ahead. Keep blaming stuff, trying to get it to stop with willpower. How has that worked out for you so far? Till you finally see that there's no end to things you can blame for making you not okay. That guy is a shapeshifter, like the sea god Proteus, who, as you try to hold him still, changes from lion to leopard to pig to tree to water. Judge not. As blame and judgment lift, something perhaps unexpected begins to take their place. Compassion, feeling with. When we stop judging our chosen that guys as bad guys in black hats, and for that matter stop venerating our chosen these guys as good guys in white hats, then everyone is left hatless, just guys. Then we can start to see them as they are, at their core, pure, spotless beingness, just like us. The rest, an impossibly complex product of chains of cause and effect, reaching back to the nutritional content of the breakfast they ate this morning, to their last 7 years of hating their crummy job, to their sweet marriage, to the little girl in the sandbox who broke their heart in kindergarten, to the DNA they got from their parents, yada, 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 back to the Big Bang. Also just like us. Every one of us, tender, vulnerable, confused, just trying to figure it all out. Every one of us, someone's little baby, toddling off on our own, trying to find that love again, bumping into things, making messes. That's another thing I've learned about in prison. At my very first session at Northern State, on a cold night in January 2005, three guys showed up. Two of them seemed bored and distracted, probably medicated, and not sure what they were doing there. They stopped coming after another week or two. The third, whom I'll call Duffy, kept showing up. He had been practicing Zen at another prison before coming to Northern. He was in his late 30s, sharp, funny, well-read, serious about his practice. I found out later that he wrote poetry and did hospice work for dying prisoners, sometimes sitting up for days at a time, holding their hands, changing their diapers. Afterward, as I walked across the parking lot, I started wondering what he was doing in a maximum security prison. He must have been one of those nonviolent drug offenders you hear about, who sell a little pot to a narc after the narc lures them into a school zone to jack up their sentence by another 10 years. When I got home, I went straight to my laptop and logged onto the New Jersey Department of Corrections website. I knew that each inmate has his own page, with mugshot, rap sheet, aliases, and parole date. I did a search, and up came Duffy's page. Admission date, December 1990. Parole eligibility date, December 2020. Offenses, robbery, aggravated assault, murder. I decided not to look up anyone else's page. They didn't know the worst thing I'd ever done, and I didn't want to know theirs. My job was to encourage their highest aspiration. Their lowest moment was not my business. Still, though, the question remained in the back of my mind. How did smart, sensitive, articulate Duffy, with no economic disadvantage or racial prejudice to struggle against, wind up doing 30 years for murder? One night, about 4 years later, the guys got me telling a few stories of my hitchhiking adventures in the 60s, some of them comical, some of them hair-raising. At the end of the session, as guys filed out the door and retrieved their ID cards from the lobby officer, Duffy caught up with me and said, "Yeah, the first time I went hitchhiking out of Florida was when I was 15 and ran away from home. That was right after my dad raped both of my sisters." Oh. My feet kept walking, but my mind reeled as I digested this information. Suddenly, I didn't need to know any more details, any of the steps between point A, the sin of the father, and point Z, the utter waste of life that was Duffy's incarceration. I felt the tide-like force with which his whole life had been impelled to this bleak spot. Tears sprang to my eyes. Fuck. Some people never have a chance. "Good stories," said Duffy. He picked up his ID and walked into the night. Chapter 31. The Exploded Moment. Please try this. Press the tips of your thumb and forefinger together. You don't have to press hard. Experience that pressure. This is not a thought or an abstraction, but an experience. Completely simple, completely ordinary. Now, stop pressing. Now press again, but do it 3 seconds ago. Can't? Then try doing it 3 seconds in the future. No? If some wise guy waits 3 seconds and then triumphantly presses his digits together, has he succeeded in doing it in the future? No. As they say, the future lies ahead, and always will. All action, experience, feeling, thought, everything happens in the present. All happening happens in the present. Everything but the present is absent. You can never experience the past or the future. Our wise guy might say, "Sure, I can experience the past. In fact, right now I can remember what I had for breakfast this morning." But the key words are right now. What we call memory is a thought, and it's experienced in the present, like all thoughts and all other experiences. It's a thought about the past, and it can come in assorted flavors, that is, with assorted linked feelings, such as regret or nostalgia. We can also have thoughts about the future, called expectation, and they can come in such flavors as hope or dread. In fact, we can have a thought about anything we want, but there's only one time we can have it, and that's now. Beyond that, we're trying to steal time that doesn't exist. We're the world's worst bandits. There's a piece of advice that's so popular it's become a spiritual cliché. Be here now. That's unassailable, but it can also be misleading. It sounds as if other options are available, as if you have a choice. Sure, be here now. Where the hell else can you be? Even to say you can never experience the past or the future is misleading. It sounds as if there are these two places called past and future lurking somewhere that happens to be inaccessible to us, just around some fourth-dimensional blind corner. If only we looked through the right kind of wormhole with the right kind of super periscope, we could see them. But there are no such places, except in thought, which is present. And once we've seen through the myth of those two places, our old unexamined sense of present as a third place, the place between those other two places, also starts to evaporate. Then what's left? Just this. Here we are. There's no good word for this. Our language has evolved over the centuries to describe the world of time. But beyond that, it breaks down. We can say timelessness, but it's a shame that we have to describe what is in terms of what isn't. It's like naming your precious child not a monster. But more important than naming is seeing. When we clearly see the insubstantiality of the past, then the regret and nostalgia and pain, resentment, confusion, etc., that once bred there, begin to lose their power over us. When we clearly see the insubstantiality of the future, then the hope and dread and anxiety, apprehension, etc., that once bred there, begin to lose their power over us. They have nowhere to breed. We see that clearly, and we're in the clear. Of course, when people say, "be here now," they really mean it's easy to get so caught up in memories and expectations that it's as if they're reality, and then we miss the real reality, like a person caught in a dream. Dreaming the future, we can get lost in feverish, anxiety-laden dramas that never transpire. Dreaming the past, we can become embroiled in angry fights with people, our parents say, who are no longer even alive. A few years ago, at a workshop I led in Northern California, one participant suddenly realized that a trauma she had regarded as the fundamental hurt of her life, something she had remembered a friend doing to her decades earlier and which she had carried as an open wound ever since, was a complete misunderstanding. It never happened. A related bit of well-worn advice is, live in the moment. Again, that's the right idea, but it also slips a joker into the deck, the concept of a moment, a unit, a little particle of time. And the concept of time is a bunch of those particles arranged in a long, long line. All those timelines of history and geography you drew back in grade school bolstered this concept. But there ain't no such animal. There's only the timeless this. Go back and check as many times as necessary, putting the tips of your thumb and forefinger together, or doing anything else. As it happens, the word moment shares its roots with momentum, which implies some driving force that impels constant movement through that long line of particles. Sharing the root as well is momentous, which implies importance or weight, and the fishy proposition that some moments are weightier than others. So, while living in the moment is certainly better, truer, more liberating than living in dreams of past and future, it would be better yet to explode the whole concept, blow up those non-existent particles, and live in the clear, open space that's left. When we don't, then life is like that long road trip to Disneyland with your kids in the back seat. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Now are we there yet? By being caught in momentum, in urgent movement toward a future moment that will be more momentous than this one, the kids create their own suffering. Most adults do this less noisily, but they still do it. Up in the driver's seat, although you see that the traffic to the Disneyland entrance is backed up, you may still be caught in the urge to keep your momentum going and arrive sooner than later. Then you suffer that familiar straining at the harness feeling, as you grip the wheel and lean forward, as if trying to push the traffic out of the way with your body. That doesn't work. But now, suppose you glance over to the next lane and see a bus driver who does this every day, for whom arriving 5 minutes earlier or later is not so momentous. He's stuck in exactly the same traffic as you are, but he's not stuck in the same suffering. Once again, the key is clear noticing. When you notice yourself straining forward and know clearly that it doesn't move the traffic faster, but it does make the imaginary time move slower, you can breathe out and drop the whole thing. On that road trip, by the way, you've just experienced firsthand the core of the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths. Truth number one, human life is subject to suffering. Check. Obvious. Truth number two, we create our own suffering by mentally straining against the harness of circumstances, trying to magically turn what isn't into what is. Not so obvious. Truth number three, when we stop trying to do the impossible, see number two, we relax into reality, and then suffering evaporates. Whew, that's a relief. Truth number four, stabilizing that whew of relief so that it becomes perpetual takes some practice, clear seeing, regular meditation, and sensible ethical conduct so you don't get bogged down in a lot of distracting drama. Unsurprisingly, some of the champions of applying this teaching in the real world have been Tibetan Buddhist monks. I've met a few who were tortured when the Chinese communists overran Tibet. One of them described how he and his colleagues were bound by the wrists, the other ends of the ropes attached to pulleys on the ceiling, and pulled tight so that the monks had to stand for hours on tiptoe with their arms stretched above their heads. Of course that's going to be excruciatingly painful, no matter what. But, as the saying goes, pain is mandatory. Suffering is optional. Your kids in the back seat suffered, even though they had no pain. These monks had plenty of pain, but their suffering was, if not absent, certainly much less than it would be for most people. Having practiced seeing through time, they knew how to abide in timelessness, rather than keep amplifying their misery by straining against circumstances, fantasizing about the momentous moment of their release, and asking, "Are we there yet?" Only when there's time, duration, is there suffering to be endured. The monks also practiced loving their torturers. As always, it's good to do the fire drill before the fire, as these monks had. Then, when our own potentially torturous circumstances come along, the broken leg, the broken career, the broken romance, We know how to minimize our suffering by exploding the moments into timelessness. And that ability is strengthened every time we meditate. The movement that's most deeply implicated in generating the appearance of time is the movement of thought. In meditation, we simply relax beneath that movement, like sinking below the waves, into the silent ocean water that's always just a few feet below the surface, even as the waves roll on. When we rest as awareness, we're resting in timelessness, growing more familiar with it so we can more readily notice it once we open our eyes. Most people notice timelessness only in exceptional situations. When they finally have the first kiss with the long-sought lover, or they have their astonishingly in-the-flow, happening-all-by-itself performance on stage, or they play their peak, in-the-zone, can't-miss-the-basket game. They'll often say, "Time stood still," and they're almost right. There actually was no time to stand still, or to stand anywhere. There's nowhere for it to stand. They just briefly noticed the timeless this that always is. There was a parting of the clouds, and they said, "Oh, look, the sky has appeared." But the sky's always there, and now we're learning to sense and enjoy its presence, no matter the weather. In his sonnet, on first looking into Chapman's Homer, John Keats evokes the cloud-parting, time-stopping, mind-silencing quality of such experiences, likening them to the first view of a planet or an ocean. "Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez when, with wondering eyes, he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien." Chapter 32. Bruegel to the Rescue. We can find cues to our clearer view wherever we look. How about Rembrandt? You've probably seen his portraits before, with their startling inner depth. But now that we've been exploring our own inner depths, let's take another look and see what they can show us about the place beyond fear. Rembrandt's self-portrait with beret, which you can see on the Fearless page of my website, was painted around 1655, after success, wealth, and happy marriage had given way to widowhood, sexual scandal, legal nightmares, sickening betrayal, and the constant threat of bankruptcy. Here he's about 50, but looks older and wearier. Every blotch, sag, and jowl is unsparingly rendered, as are the permanent furrows of concentration between his eyebrows. This is the face of one who has seen much, seeing is his job, endured much, made mistakes. We see Rembrandt's fine sensitivity and fierce intelligence, as well as his fatigue, his deep sadness, his battered pride. But behind that, there's a stiffening of the spine that we can almost feel, a stubborn resolve to persevere. And behind that is the painting's deepest magic, the light of the transcendent, boundless beingness shining through it all. You can't miss it. Earlier artists were limited to showing divinity shining through idealized saints and prettied-up royals. Court painters were the cosmetic surgeons of their day. But the rise of humanism freed Rembrandt to show the divinity of ordinariness, the soul glowing through jowls and sags, the peace that passeth all understanding, illuminating a face that's a battleground of folly and hard-won wisdom. This is us, blotches and all, nirvana and all. And therefore, this is also an object of meditation. Spend a few minutes looking into those eyes and watch everything open up, the heroic striving as well as that which is beyond all strife, peering as deep into us as we peer into it. In fact, it was during Rembrandt's lifetime that our modern concept of the autonomous individual, with unique struggles and gifts, emerged. Rembrandt was born only a few years after Shakespeare created Hamlet, the first fully fleshed-out, complex, modern individual in literature. At the head of a long line of striving, often self-destructive rebels, geniuses, and maniacs, from Faust and Ahab to Hester Prynne and Scarlett O'Hara. But along the way, the drama of the individual's storm and stress has often overshadowed the transcendent spark behind it all, the spark we see in Rembrandt's eyes. Even for us ordinary non-geniuses, this history has informed our sense of ourselves and our lives. We can feel as if we're flying solo in a one-seater plane, encountering heavy turbulence without a star to guide us. The missing star is Rembrandt's spark, which we're now recovering through our meditative practice. That's a big part of the solution. Another part of the solution is Peter Bruegel the Elder, whose finest works are also objects of meditation. Bruegel painted some two generations before Rembrandt, and rather than piercing close-ups, he specialized in long shots of crowded landscapes. In his Children's Games, which is also on my website, we see the edge of a town that appears for some reason to have been taken over by a great swarm of more than 100 unsupervised children of various ages, from toddlers to teenagers. They do handstands and somersaults, play tiddlywinks and mumbledypeg, give noogies, wear grotesque masks, mother their dolls, stage mock religious processions, and blow up pig bladder balls. Also, one kid is taking a poo, and another is happily poking at a pile of poo with a stick. Good times. As with Rembrandt, the more you look at a Bruegel, the more you see. But rather than going deep into one individual, here our vision spreads wide into the group. Every face and garment, every hoop and soap bubble is carefully wrought in exquisite detail. Each person is microscopically fascinating, but no person is the person, the center of interest. Each is an inseparable part of the whole. There's a visual rhythm that runs through the crowd, like the rhythm of ripples on a lake. They're individuals, but there's a subtle something the same uniting them all. The composition is like a Where's Waldo puzzle without a Waldo. The star of the show is no one and therefore everyone, nowhere and therefore everywhere. The Rembrandt vision gives us the great man theory, where history is driven by a few extraordinary Napoleons. Bruegel's vision fits the more modern view, of a world shaped by huge, ragged tides of collective economic and social behavior. Rembrandt is protagonist-driven Hollywood movies, where the action hero becomes our vicarious ego, saving the world single-handed. Sitting in the darkened theater, we lose ourselves in him, feeling his triumphs and his pain as our reality, unlike the abstract fun pain he inflicts on the bad guys. For 2 hours, Tom Cruise or Dwayne Johnson is ourself, and all the others are, well, others, and therefore expendable. Bruegel balances that out. He brings the Downton Abbey or Game of Thrones vision, sprawling episodic TV drama with big ensemble casts, compelling us to spread a wider net of identity and empathy. Everybody's real, everybody's important, everybody hurts sometimes, and no one has the pressure of being the singular center of the universe. Sure, you're unique, just like everybody else. Yeah, you're important, like every other leaf on this tree. This view drains the desperate urgency out of our drama. We're all others. Or, altogether, we're I and I and I and I, e pluribus unum. Perhaps the most important line in the Bible, in Luke 17:21, has two competing English translations, hinging on the interpretation of the Greek preposition entos. The kingdom of God is within you versus the kingdom of God is among you. Rembrandt gives us within. Bruegel gives us among. Go deep within yourself, using the close-up macro lens, and lose yourself in the zone, the inner kingdom of open space that transcends all problems and limits. Or walk among the others, using the wide-angle lens, and discover that you remain in that zone even in the wide world, in communion with your fellow pedestrians, dreamily zoning along with you whether they notice or not. There's nothing we have to do about any of this. This is view, not method. Once we see that the sovereign, isolated, gloriously doomed little self is a paper tiger, all the self's fears and woes start to unravel. That unraveling takes some time, but there is a simple way to goose it along. Don't take things personally. When you're stuck at the red light, it's only a red light from the point of view of the protagonist you've consented to be, the one eye that's been plucked out from 7 billion. If you give up the mantle of I, or just learn to wear it lightly, you can share I and I-ness with the drivers on the cross street, for whom the light is green. Why dig deeper into your irritation and impatience when you can joyously zoom along with them instead? Shanti Deva says, all the happiness in this world arises from wishing joy for others. All the unhappiness in this world comes from wishing joy for oneself. You can't fixate on poor me unless you're fixating on me. Depressed? Discouraged? Go work in a soup kitchen. Pull weeds in the community garden. Tutor kids in reading skills. It doesn't have to be dramatic. Try to get every clerk and barista and bus driver you deal with today to smile. This other orientation, selflessness in both senses of the word, is the great secret of parenthood. Now that, out of the 7 billion so-called others in the world, there's one that you care more about than yourself, one that without hesitation you dive in front of a truck to save, you're shedding the straitjacket of small selfhood. This is what makes parenthood a spiritual path. In the same way it can make marriage or friendship or any form of love a spiritual path. It may start out as, what's in it for me? But if you stay on the path, somewhere along the line, me starts to soften and melt, while you weren't looking because you were too busy caring for the other. And as me melts, so does worrying about me and fearing for me. Chapter 33. Nothing Sticks. In the old days in Tibet, certain sages would wear a small round mirror made of polished metal, called a melong, hanging around their necks. In their business of helping people free themselves from suffering, this was the one visual aid they wanted handy at all times. When a seeker of wisdom came to a sage's hut from a nearby village, the sage might invite him to sit and they would meditate together. Afterward, the sage might hold up the melong and say something like, "What color is the mirror? Look, when I hold this apple in front of it, the mirror appears red. Now, when I hold this hunk of black barley bread in front of it, the mirror appears black. So, what color is the mirror?" "Well," the seeker might reply, "first it's red, then it's black. Later it could be other colors." "But in that case," says the sage, "can we really say that those are the mirror's colors? If the mirror only shows black when the bread is near, then we can't really say the black color belongs to the mirror. So, what color is the mirror?" The seeker hesitates. "No color?" "That must be it, mustn't it? It reflects all colors, but it itself is colorless. In fact, its colorlessness is what allows it to reflect all colors. That's why it can even reflect black and red at the same time. Now, consider that your awareness is like the mirror, empty and open to reflect all colors. Unlike a physical mirror, it also reflects sounds, tastes, smells, textures, feelings, and thoughts. Yet, just like the mirror, it remains empty, free of all that it reflects. Is that consistent with what you experience? Please look. See if your awareness has a color. Is it yellow? Purple? No, it's colorless. Is it sour or sweet? No, it's tasteless. Walking through the valley to get here this morning, you saw rocks and wildflowers and the vultures circling overhead. You felt the heat of the sun and heard the sound of the streams, and perhaps you thought of your family back at home. All those came and went within your awareness, arising, changing, vanishing, but awareness remained, ever the same, ever untouched, just as it remains now. Is that your experience? Yes. All right. What about this? The sage holds the apple in front of the mirror again. What if I keep holding it there for a day, a week? Will the red color stick to it? No, nothing sticks. If you look at the apple for a day or a week, will the red color stick to your awareness? No. And the same will be true for the other experiences reflected in your awareness. Sound, touch, taste, smell, thought, feeling. Nothing sticks to the mirror of awareness. In fact, do we have to wait for the objects to be removed for the mirror to be free of their qualities? Please, take your time. Consider carefully. Look carefully. No. My awareness remains colorless even while reflecting colors. If I taste honey, I'll be aware of sweetness, but my awareness itself still has no flavor. Clarity, emptiness is its quality. Freedom from all reflected qualities is the quality that allows it to reflect them. Very good. And that must include the thoughts and feelings that awareness reflects, whether the feelings are happy or sad, mild or intense. Awareness is always free of them, even while they're present, and even if they're present for many years. As you say, nothing sticks. The seeker looks uncertain. But wait, there's a widow in my village whose husband died 7 years ago. She's been sad ever since. It would seem that the sad feeling has stuck to her awareness. Yes, it would seem that way. That's a common sight, isn't it? But is it so? The sadness has been present, reflected in her awareness for 7 years, just as the red of the apple could continue reflected in the mirror for a long time. But only if we keep holding the apple in front of it. The widow keeps holding on to her sadness. Her awareness remains free, but she doesn't know it yet. How can she know it? Let's return to that question in a moment. First, let me ask you this. Where is the body in this scheme of things? Is your body the mirror of awareness? Or is it, like the thoughts and feelings, something reflected in the mirror? You look confused. Let's put that another way. Do you experience your body? Yes. Yes, it's something you experience. When you were a little boy, you experienced a different body. When you're an old man like me, you'll experience yet another body. Actually, there have been many bodies, and there will be many more as it changes incessantly. Who or what experiences all those bodies? Well, I do. Indeed, you are not the body. You are the experiencer, the unchanging awareness that's aware of the always changing body. You are the mirror, and by nature you're free of body, thoughts, feelings, suffering, sadness, fear, and anything else you may ever reflect, even when they're present. Nothing sticks to the mirror.
Yes, but it doesn't feel that way. When bad things happen, I feel pain. If there's a fire in my village and people lose their homes, telling them that they're free and their grief is merely a reflected sensation won't ease their suffering. Telling suffering beings that they're free doesn't seem compassionate. Compassion requires me to house them, clothe them, feed them.
It absolutely does. We always attend to the practical first. You and I are able to enjoy this conversation because we've had breakfast and aren't distracted by our rumbling bellies. But why is it that people don't feel free of their suffering when in truth they are pure, untainted awareness that is free? Whether it's your widow or your fire victims, why does the mirror seem lost in the reflection and stained with its colors? Because the reflection is what we're in the habit of paying attention to. When you look in the mirror to check if your hat is on straight, you see the hat, not the mirror. Precisely because awareness is such a good mirror, with no cracks or discolorations, without even shape or edges, we see everything else and forget the mirror. Because it's perfectly empty, open, and clear, we don't see it.
Then what can we do?
Asks the seeker. We have to take time to see the mirror, to become aware of awareness. Then, when we're called by the business of the world, when our action is required to help alleviate suffering, we can act even while remaining aware of awareness. We can act from freedom.
But how do we become aware of awareness? How do we see the mirror?
There are two ways. One way is practice, meditation, where we allow all the objects that are reflected in the awareness mirror to fade temporarily into the background of our attention, so that awareness itself comes to the foreground. As for the other, well, have you found that this conversation has made you a bit more aware of awareness? We've been using words, but we've been using them to point to something beyond words, wordless, thingless, silent, clear like a crystal, always present, always free. Do you find that you have some sharpened sense of that right now?
The seeker begins to answer, but then stops. For a long time he gazes down at his hands, then slowly looks around the hut, as if seeing it for the first time, as if waking from a dream. Then he looks back at the sage. The seeker's gaze, which till now has been lowered, deferential, is steady. His posture has straightened. He sits tall, and a smile spreads across his face.
Yes, I do have that sharpened sense, right now. This is the second way, view. The seeker places his palms together and bows toward the sage.
Thank you so much, teacher.
The sage smiles and bows back. Thank you. Chapter 34, November 9th, 2016. It's just past dusk, and I'm walking north on Lincoln Boulevard, eating the exhaust and staring down the headlight glare of rush hour traffic. Last night, Yaffa and I stayed up late watching the election returns on my laptop. I was complacent at first, telling her, as I had for months, that there was nothing to worry about. Then the North Carolina vote came in, and as the night went on, we were confused, then shocked, disbelieving, angry, and finally very scared. A crude, reckless, ignorant thug had taken over our country by stirring hate and selling empty promises to suckers. Eventually, we got 3 or 4 hours of broken sleep, then awoke much as we did the morning after 9/11. Did that really happen? Jesus God, it really did. Lincoln Boulevard is beautiful Santa Monica's least beautiful street.
It's the unloved but necessary street that most cities of a certain size have. Gas stations and tire shops, McDonald's and 7-Eleven, budget dental clinics and discount clothing stores, notary publics and sad-looking little legal offices.